Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we're talking with Thomas Beller. His new book is Degas at the Gas Station, Essays. And Megan Holt previews this year's Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans. Thomas Beller is Director of Creative Writing and Professor of English at Tulane University. He's a regular contributor to The New Yorker and the author of several books, both fiction and nonfiction. When last we spoke, we talked about his book Lost in the Game, a book about basketball. And today we're talking about a new collection, Degas at the Gas Station, Essays. Tom, welcome back.
So very nice to be here, Susan. Thank you.
This is such a generous collection of essays. So wide-ranging. So many lovely pieces about New York. You give us such a psychic map. Even the apartment building where you grew up is the gift that keeps on giving. So Tell us about it.
You know, the landscape of one's childhood is something that usually provides a lot of grist, and I've come back to it in earlier work. I've written about my childhood in that building, but in this book, I'm writing about my children's childhood or my life as a father at visiting the building or being in the building.
Describe it for us.
It's kind of stately in the pre-war building on the Upper West Side of Manhattan that in my novel, The Sleepover Artist, a lot of these old buildings have names, you know, like the Ardsley or the Beresford or the Dakota, most famously, where John Lennon lived. And I gave that building the name the Babe Ruth, because Babe Ruth indeed did live in the building. And then his wife lived in the building. She outlived him for a long time. And so, you know, even into the 80s, you had this doorman named Steve showed me this ball, an autographed Babe Ruth baseball that...
What a treasure.
That Babe Ruth's widow had given him. Anyway, so it's big and the basement area is a bit labyrinthine and there's two staircases. And there was a bunch of kids my age when I was growing up, so it was sort of a world into itself.
That sounds like a lot of fun in many ways. So much of this is about fatherhood and your own experiences as a father of two young children and exploring your own father's identity. You know, anyone whose father dies when they're nine has a mystery to solve, and you're trailing this essence. And I thought it was so interesting that you saw him write, but you never found his writing, really.
Oh, my God. I mean, I just need to somewhat unctuously say that, Susan, you're such a gift. You're like my best reader. I can't believe it. So nice to hear you talk about this. The introduction of the book meanders into the fact that my dad was a psychoanalyst. And as a young kid, I would sometimes, if I woke up in the middle of the night, or once specifically, went to the bathroom, looked into the study where he sat at the French desk in front of a typewriter. So I had seen this. He clearly was writing things.
Yeah.
Then as an adult, I thought to look for them, and it turns out that he didn't publish anything. And I started to get a bit anxious about, oh my God, am I the son of a blocked writer in some way, or what's going on? And because good friends of his who were colleagues at the Columbia Psychoanalytic Institute were still family friends, I was able to talk to them about it. And they sort of reassured me that they were all quite intimidated by like the establishment at the time. None of them were publishing at the time he died. And a few years later, they all began to publish. That sort of leads to some other things in that introduction. But yeah, it's very smart of you and nice of you to say that anyone whose dad died has a mystery to solve. And then in my case, my dad had grown up in Vienna and had to leave abruptly in 1938 with his other members of his family. And it was a very chaotic process, which I never got any direct information about. No one talked to me about it. My dad died long before I would have thought to ask. My aunt died more or less right around the time I was starting to ask. But there was an uncle. The beginning and the end touches on this complicated relationship I had with my uncle, who didn't want to talk about any of it.
Right. But there's something so, that image of him sitting at the desk has such staying power. It's so dreamlike, but at the same time, it's so concrete. You know, that's a gift to carry with you, I think.
Thank you. This is like my first interview with this book, and you never know what people take from a book once you've put it together. So I'm delighted to hear you focusing on that.
Well, there's a lot to take from this one. So talk about why you chose this particular title, why you named it for this essay.
Okay, so this is
the New Orleans part.
This is a complicated question because I don't know how honest I want to be. Suffice it to say, I had a lot of time putting this together. Versions of it have existed for a long time. Things got modified or added or subtracted. And along with the different iterations were different titles. And none of them seemed very good, frankly, and very lively. They were all sort of ponderous. I don't even want to start talking about them. And there was this essay called Degas at the Gas Station. And my wife, Elizabeth, said, why don't you make that the title? And as soon as I thought of it, I was like, I could have had a V8 sort of moment.
But describe what the essay is about, because it's a moment that many New Orleans parents can identify with.
Oh, well, it's just a very brief vignette in which I go to pick up my daughter from dance class. She's like 6, and we're on basically St. Charles and Carrollton, sort of on River Road. Mm-hmm. And she comes out expecting her mother, sees me, is like slightly nonplussed, asks for something to drink. I take her down the street to that, I think it's a Getty station on the corner of Carrollton and St. Charles, and essentially buy her something to drink.
Yeah.
And some things happen while we're there, nothing too dramatic, but it's very heightened feeling of excitement on my part. And she's just in this divine state of being herself without any particular self-consciousness or awareness. And it just was a very striking experience, which I wanted to write down.
Well, it's also very visually appealing when you imagine it, you know. Now, I wonder if you would read a little bit from Evacuation, because it is such a perfect description of that process.
Sure. So this is a piece called Evacuation. Evacuating from a hurricane is like being asked to leave a room where your friend will soon be beaten up. You step into the adjoining room and can hear the blows, the cries of pain. A house is not a friend exactly, but maybe a city is. You hear it all, but you can't see it. Or you see it, but you can't stop it. Even before the lights go out, you're powerless. You simply have to endure it. Just things you say, or people say to you. Possessions. Not as bad as actually dying and suffering. But it is very strange. Imagining the roof of your house blown off, the windows blown out, walls moldy and wet. I thought of all the people in New Orleans who don't have to imagine because they lived through Katrina. I arrived 3 years after that event, when you could still smell the vapors of PTSD, and, as in my piece, The Topographical Soul, I made the association with Phnom Penh, two cities with the rare distinction of being completely emptied. That it was 16 years to the day between Katrina and Ida was both beside the point and also overdetermined. Major weather events were punctuation marks in the life of a place and the lives of the people who lived there. But what kind of punctuation was never known in advance? Quote, those who can leave should leave, is how the mayor defined the voluntary evacuation for which he had called on Friday. As Jarvis DeBerry, a local columnist, quipped, this was also the definition of a mandatory evacuation. In either case, those who can't leave don't. This moment in time in the late summer of 2021 echoed slightly the moment in the spring of 2020, specifically late February and early March, when everyone in America began to brace for the arrival of COVID. I shouldn't even bring this up. It's apples and oranges, contagious virus on one hand, weather on the other, but they share the quality of realities to which individuals can respond, but they cannot control. In both instances, those who could evacuate if they chose to do so, and those who couldn't go anywhere if they wanted to. There were those who could evacuate or not go anywhere. In both situations, people relied on magical thinking, wishful thinking, and had confused and genuinely ambivalent feelings about how best to proceed. On Thursday and Friday, we were a city full of hamlets. To go or not to go, that was the question. But most people got off the fence by Friday night.
I mean, that is such a perfect New Orleans moment. The essay that struck me as like the perfect mashup, as it were, was The Egg Cream in Mid-Manhattan, 1982.
Wow.
It struck me that you were perhaps claiming a little Ignatius street cred for yourself.
Fascinating. Why? Because it's such a nutty thing to do?
Yes. And yet I had no problem whatsoever imagining you doing it.
Yeah.
I mean. So tell us about that.
I had an experience in the summer before my senior year of high school that in hindsight seems completely batty and full of entrepreneurial initiative in ways that are kind of impressive. But at the time, it just was life as it unfolded. I had some difficulties at school. I was in the habit of making quasi-prank phone calls to people who'd placed ads in the New York Times under the business opportunity section. Mm-hmm. I whimsically called a guy who was looking to sell his vending cart business for what turned out to be $1 million, and I called him from a payphone at the library. I actually managed to lower my voice enough to make him take me slightly seriously as a potential buyer of the company, and then I actually got interested. And I'd been a bike messenger the previous summer and had leveled up to being a bike messenger salesman, by which I mean I would go to different mailrooms and try to find the person who ran the mailroom and convince them to switch their messenger service to my guy. And just for the record, the guy who was nicest to me in one of these giant glass towers on 6th Avenue was the guy who ran the mailroom at something called Freeport MacMoran.
Oh my gosh, another New Orleans.
Exactly.
Jeez.
And that just was a tiny recessive detail of my life until I got to New Orleans and I went, hey. But
wow.
So I don't know, I'd had a kind of residency in Midtown.
Entrepreneurial spirit.
That I knew my way around Midtown. I liked that New York City was having a boom in street vending foods. Yeah. Larry's Ices, Chip Witch is probably the one thing that's lasted from that era, but that started as a just carts.
Oh, but I always think of Chestnuts and Pretzels.
Well, that's so that was what was tricky was there's the Chestnuts, Pretzels, Hot Dogs guy.
Yeah.
They're the lifers. They're there.
The
and then
lifers.
You have these newbies with their kooky, you know, Frozade or Larry's Ices or the dude with his espresso bespoke thing or the dumplings guy, which some of these things are now in the same way that you can talk about sushi and not blink twice. It's an obvious, it's like talking about a hamburger. But at that time in the early 80s, all this had a kind of exotic tang to it. And one of these things sold a strange kind of chewy New York City drink called an egg cream, which oddly has no egg in it. It's seltzer, a little milk, some syrup, some chocolate, vanilla, half and half. I ended up contracting, instead of buying the whole company, I contracted for one cart. And
scaling down.
Considerably. He was pretty, I never met the actual guy who I was talking to, but props to him for, you know, and he did make some money for me. I mean, I did pay him a weekly rent. So the piece looks back on this period when I was standing on the street at a cart that made a drink that was sold for $1. You get a free pretzel. I set up outside of what was then the ABC building at 54th Street and 6th Avenue, out of which sometimes some colorful people would come, like the members of the Stray Cats full regalia, and also Howard Cosell. That was also very exciting for me. And who would have known, you know, wasn't interested in the egg cream, but sort of waved in recognition, I guess his childhood or something. So you're asking about this essay. I was actually approached by an editor at Gourmet Magazine named Jocelyn Zuckerman, who had been signing up interesting characters like, David Foster Wallace wrote Consider the Lobster for the same vertical of sort of literary writers take on a food-related subject. And I wrote a piece for them. And then some years later, something came up and I was moved to revisit it. And I really should probably revisit the material because it was incredibly rich. I just ended up spending all my time.
Oh, so much fun to imagine you doing that.
You know, I had this sort of entrepreneur's epiphany that, like, you have to work till about some, at some point on Thursday, I would make my nut.
Right.
And then every sale after that moment was just my dollar. Mm-hmm. And so I just ended up working all the time.
And the economics of this become so clear in this essay.
I know. It was pretty cool. And then I got punched in the face and on and on.
On and on. Oh, my gosh. Now, some of these essays are written long after the fact, obviously. Were there any that you just raced home to write?
Yes. Actually, I was thinking about this. I sometimes raced home to write. One of these pieces was written largely in the men's locker room of the JCC in New Orleans.
Whoa.
I should quickly add, it's in no way about the men's locker room of the JCC in New Orleans.
That's wise.
The piece, How I Lost My iPhone in New Orleans. This is now, again, a kind of a mundane wrinkle of modern life, but my iPhone was stolen. I was able to track it and essentially find it. And that whole process turned into a bit of a three-act play.
Well, there are lots of losses in this collection.
Yes.
iPods, you know, iPhones, wallets, all kinds of things. People. But
yeah, since you mentioned people along with the objects, it never occurred to me that my, I don't know how to put this, I wouldn't want to call it propensity, maybe vulnerability to losing things has a corollary of finding them, which one often does, and getting mm-hmm. them back. But that doesn't apply to the people if you lose a person.
Right. But luckily for readers, some of them are finding the people in this for the first time.
Well, I'm just struck by your connecting those lost and found as it pertains to the important people in one's life. And
well, it's a wonderful book. Wonderful book. We've been talking with Thomas Beller, whose new book is Degas at the Gas Station, Essays. You can meet him Wednesday, November 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. Tom, thanks so much. It's always a treat.
Such a nice experience to be here with you again, Susan.
It is a great pleasure to welcome Megan Holt, Executive Director of One Book, One New Orleans, and Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, back to the reading life, because it's words and music time, isn't it?
Indeed it is.
And it begins this week and carries on through next weekend?
That's correct.
So tell us what we're up for this year.
All right. So we are going to do a very special virtual opener this year. And that is a tribute to Dr. Jerry W. Ward, who transitioned this past February. He was really instrumental when One Book, One New Orleans assumed the directorship of Words and Music in shaping the vision and thinking about how the arts can be for the people. And every time I organize a festival, I organize it with his voice in my ear. And we're very, very honored to have this virtual event curated by Kelly Harris DeBerry. Hopefully folks from around the country and the world will tune in to honor Dr. Ward.
Great man, great writer.
Absolutely.
You know. And one of the things you've been so wonderfully successful at is carving out this niche about writing about social justice and what literature means in a life. So tell us some of the Reading for Justice programming you've got coming up, because it's really interesting this year.
Thank you. We're bookending the festival this year, beginning and ending with that idea of what literature can do specifically for folks who have been formerly or currently incarcerated. So we're opening on November 19th, which is Wednesday at 6:30 p.m., Reading for Justice from Incarceration to Exoneration. We've got HNOC's new book about the captive state exhibit paired with Calvin Duncan's book, The Jailhouse Lawyer. And we put those two together because it really does sort of present both sides of this conversation. On one side, you've got the academic look at incarceration. And on the other hand, you have the story of someone who lived it. And those both are very necessary when we talk about the problem of mass incarceration. We're ending on the 22nd of November with Poetry Inside Prisons. That will be
right.
Allison Pellegrin, Adam Clay, and Michael Clipper Diggs talking about the work that we're doing bringing poetry inside carceral facilities throughout the state of Louisiana, because One Book, One New Orleans and Allison Pellegrin just partnered to get an NEA big grant to do just that.
That's exciting, isn't it?
It is. It's our first one.
Oh, God. Now, another area of programming that I, of course, love this year is libraries. So tell a little bit about that.
We've got a love up on our libraries.
We do.
So much for so many people. And so this year we've got back-to-back events, giving the library some love. We've got Free for All the Public Library on Friday evening. That is the PBS documentary. We're very lucky that we have a local producer in town, Tim Watson, who worked on that film. And Don Logsdon is also going to be there, the director. They'll be interviewed by A.E. Rooks. So we'll screen the film and then have a conversation with the folks who made it. And then we'll go directly into another event curated by Kelly Harris DeBerry. And that is a reading by different poets and writers about what the library has meant to them and how it shaped their lives.
Including a very young Naomi DeBerry.
A very young Naomi DeBerry. She's the youngest author we've ever had at Words and Music at a whopping 13 years old.
I think she should get a sash or something.
I do too.
Now, you're going to also be debuting two literary anthologies at this year's conference.
Yes, we're very excited because our writing competition each year carries as part of the prize publication in the Limnal Anthology. So we said, of course, we should just make the launch of every issue of the Limnal Anthology part of the festival because it features the past winners. So we're doing that this year on November 20th. And then the New Orleans debut of Katrina and Rita at 20, co-edited by Mona Lisa Saloy and John Warner Smith, will take place on the 22nd of November. So we have contributors from both of those anthologies reading.
And then you have some great programming centered around this year's One Book, One New Orleans selection.
Yes, once again, back-to-back events. On the 22nd, we've got E.M. Tran, who is the author of Daughters of the New Year, our 2025 selection, in conversation with T. Bowie. And then immediately after that, high school students who use the curriculum we developed for that book will be reading pieces inspired by it. So we've got the book and then the responses to the book from creative writing students at Willow High School.
And of course, you have lots of other programming.
So much. And you can learn all about it at wordsandmusic.org.
And the winners of the Patty Friedman Creative Writing Competition.
Yes, we are so excited. We think that 4 out of the 5 winners will be able to participate this year, including the winner of the Beyond the Bars category, which is another way that we amplify formerly and currently incarcerated voices. We give a prize each year to the best piece of writing by an incarcerated juvenile. And we're very, very lucky that we think the winner will be able to get special permission to attend.
Oh, that's really great.
I'm really excited.
Now, the one thing people need to understand is that the work you do goes on all year long with different programs.
Absolutely. So anything that the festival manages to raise in terms of proceeds is kept right back here in our community to give access to books to those who typically couldn't access it. One Book, One New Orleans is always thinking about different ways that we can break down barriers between books and the people who may want to read them. And the festival supports that work.
Well done.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Susan, for your constant championing of that work.
Well, have a great weekend. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Megan Holt, who's the executive director of One Book, One New Orleans and Words and Music. Thanks,
Megan.
Thank you. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Anna Mathias discusses and signs her mother, Judy Montague's book, The Greyhound Diary, Saturday, November 8th at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. The Symphony Book Fair holds a pop-up sale on November 8th, Saturday, from 9 to 4 at the Symphony Book Warehouse, 623 Distributors Row, Suite F, Harahan in the Elmwood area. Proceeds go to the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra. There will be books, music, CDs, DVDs, vinyls, puzzles, and more. The event is free and open to the public. Authors and educators Bill Lofelm and Erica Welter appear at the November Saturday Writers Clinic. That's at 9:30 a.m. Saturday, November 8th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Bill Lofelm discusses building characters, creating fully realized and unique characters that leap off the page. That's at 9:30 a.m., followed by Erica Welter presenting The Art of Critiquing and Feedback at 11, free. Roger Kamenetz reads from and signs Seeing into the Life of Things, Sunday, November 9th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Nalini Jones appears in conversation with Lewis Edwards and signs The Unbroken Coast, Monday, November 10th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Cyril Lagvanik, curator of the American-Italian Research Library at the East Bank Library, gives a lecture on the Navajo Code Talkers, Monday, November 10th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Thomas Beller appears in conversation with Nathaniel Rich and signs Degas at the Gas Station Essays, Wednesday, November 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. The creators of Dead Man Walking, the graphic edition, author Sister Helen Prejean, scriptwriter Rose Vines, and artist Catherine Anyango Grunewald appear Tuesday, November 11th at 4 at Octavia Books, and again at Holy Name of Jesus Church at Loyola University, Thursday, November 13th at 7. Margaret Orr and illustrator Matt Renard sign Scrim, My Tale is Told to Margaret Orr, Thursday, November 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Carita Brown discusses and signs The Battle for the Black Mind, Thursday, November 13th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. And remember, Words and Music, starting November 19th, has released the full lineup. Start planning now at wordsandmusic.org.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.